Hi, and welcome to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers on 90.5 FM. This summer, we're featuring the best of prosody. We hope you enjoy. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Denise Duhamel. Denise Duhamel's most recent books are Ka-Ching, Two and Two, and Queen for a Day, all published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. She's also recently published a collaborative chapbook with Sandy McIntosh called 237 More Reasons to Have Sex. She is a professor at Florida International University in Miami. Hi, Denise. How are you?
Hi, Jan. Fine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're so happy that you're here from Florida. And you have so many choices. You have so many books. You've written 10 collections of poetry, which you didn't say in your bio. I mean, you have a long bio, and that's great.
Thanks.
Yeah, it
Thank
is.
You. Thanks.
So accomplished.
Means I've lived this long.
Well, trust me, a lot of writers have, and they don't have 10 books. But anyway, you're going to start with a poem from your new book, Ka-Ching.
Yes, okay. And it mentions Pittsburgh in this poem. This poem is a sestina. It's called Delta Flight 659. A sestina is a poem which uses usually six words over and over in a pattern in a 39-line poem. But this is a poem which is a sestina that cheats a little bit in its form. Delta Flight 659, dedicated to Sean Penn. I'm writing this on a plane, Sean Penn, with my black Pilot Razor ballpoint pen. Ever since 9/11, I'm a nervous flyer. I leave my Pentium processor in Florida so TSA can't x-ray my stanzas, penetrate my persona. Maybe this should be an iambic pentameter rather than this mock sestina, each line ending in a pen variant. I convinced myself the ticket to Baghdad was too expensive. I contemplated going as a human shield. I read in open-mouthed shock that your trip there was a $56,000 expenditure. Is that true? I watched you on Larry King Live, his suspenders and tie, your open collar. You saw the war's impending mess. My husband gambled on my penumbra of doubt. So you stationed yourself at a food silo in Iraq. What happens to me if you get blown up? He begged me to stay home, be his Penelope. I sit alone in coach, but last night I sat with four poets, depending on one another as readers in a Pittsburgh cafe. I tried to be your pen pal in 1987, not because of your pensive bad boy looks, but because of a poem you'd penned that appeared in an issue of Frank. I still see the poet in you, Sean Penn. You probably think fans like me are your penance for your popularity, your star bulging into a pentagon filled with witchy wannabes and penniless poets who waddle towards your icy peninsula of glamour like so many menacing penguins. But honest, I come in peace, Sean Penn, writing on my plane ride home. I want no part of your penthouse or the snowy slopes of your aspen. I won't stalk you like the swirling grime cloud over Pigpen. I have no script or stupendous novel I want you to option. I even like your wife, Robin Wright Penn. I only want to keep myself busy on this flight to tell you of four penny-loafered poets in Pennsylvania who, last night, chomping on primavera, penne, pasta, pondered poetry, celebrity, Iraq, the penitentiary of free speech. And how I've reminded everyone that Sean Penn once wrote a poem. I peer out the window, caress my lucky pendant. Look, Sean Penn, the clouds are drawn with charcoal pencils. The sky is opening like a child's first stab at penmanship. The sun begins to ripen orange, then deepen. The next poem I'm going to read is actually just part of a poem from a chapbook, a collaborative chapbook that I wrote with Sandy McIntosh called 237 More Reasons to Have Sex. And he and I wrote this poem back and forth, one line at a time by email, and it was based on a study called Why Humans Have Sex, which it was in the Archives of Sexual Behavior, Volume 36, Number 4, August 2007. And one of the co-authors, Cindy Meston, was being interviewed in the New York Times about this particular study. And her line was, originally, I thought we had exhaustively compiled the list, but now I found there are some that should be added. And that was sort of, for us, sort of an invitation to write the 237 more. So I'm going to read a bit from the beginning, their numbers, a little bit from the middle, and then a little bit from the end. So here goes. Again, this is from 237 More Reasons to Have Sex. Number 3, because I was on all fours anyway, looking for the earring I dropped under the table. 4, because of the plums, so delicious, so cold, forgive me. 5, my vibrator was in the repair shop. 6, to remember me sainted mother, Lord forgive her. 7, to be forgiven, to do my penance. 8, because of the blue light special on condoms. 9, because today was the KY Jelly's expiration date. 10, she'd brought in this vibrator, worn out. What else could I do? 11, I've always been a people pleaser. 12, because when you asked, may I borrow your pen, please, I thought you meant my penis. 13, I was turned on by your ultra-neat penmanship. 14, I thought you were asleep and would not remember me. 15, I thought you were somebody else. 16, I thought I was somebody else. 17, I thought the world was going to blow up any minute and this would be my last chance. 18, you were blocking the way to the refrigerator. 19, you tasted like a BLT. 20, you were my mayonnaise. 21, I thought it was a sign that you were humming my favorite song. 22, I thought you Frenched the bed, so I wanted to French our kiss. 23, I'd already rented the French maid's costume, so I figured I might as well do it. 24, I yearned to play the English butler because I liked the way the butler did it. 25, because I knew you were clean and would be discreet. And then now this is from the middle of the book. 104, you did a mean Band-Aid striptease. 105, my barbecue burlesque was a huge success. 106, the bartender said, this one's called Sex on the Beach. Then he winked and nudged us. 107, by the end of the night, when you swallowed the tequila worm, you were my hero. 108, we still had time left on the parking meter. 109, there was an hour to go before curfew. 110, and yes, I said, yes, I will. Yes, but stupidly you'd locked yourself in the bomb shelter and the air raid warden was handy. 111, I spun the bottle and its neck pointed to you. 112, as St. Augustine said, oh Lord, give me chastity, but meanwhile I'd like a little something right about now. 113, you promised me we could name our first daughter Chastity like Sonny and Cher had. 114, I wanted to be your Sirocco in the desert red sand. 115, I wanted to be the cocoa that warmed your hands. 116, I wanted to be your Doc Buria, deafening the ears of Greece. 117, I wanted to be your bright fury. I wanted to negotiate your year-to-year lease. 118, I wanted to be your tramontata, sucking seabed near Corsica. 119, I wanted to be your vacuum. Eureka. And this is towards the end of the book. 194. I suddenly surmised that you were part human, part bird. 195. I could smell your astonishment. 196. It was my cologne called Astonishment by Edvard Munch. 197. I was from the kingdom of the damaged. 198. I lived in a little shack just down the hill from you. 199. You were from the kingdom of the damaged. 200, halfway between the kingdom of the damaged and the hamlet of the deranged. 201, you were as irresistible and complicated as a great poem. 202, you were like a shimmering flower of eyes, hair, and petals. 203, I could hear the blood murmuring through your aqua veins as though telling me to keep things hush-hush. 204, did you hear the rustling slash shuddering slash beating of great outspread wings above us? 205, did you smell the ocean in our sheets? 206, I couldn't remember having been there before, but there was something familiar, amniotic about it. Center of rainforest, maybe? No, it was a mountain. We were halfway up the slope. 207, you were eating something, a mango, the juices of which dripped down your chin. 208. It was a lobster, I thought, but no matter. 209. Yes, that's it. You are breaking open a dappled pink claw.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Denise Duhamel, reading her poetry. I want to ask you about the new book, the collaborative book, 237 More Reasons to Have Sex. I want to talk about sort of the way that you wrote this. And I was wondering when you were talking about, you know, one line by you, one line by Sandy McIntosh, I was wondering if you view collaboration like this as a kind of form. I know you write in form often, and I wonder if you see it that way.
I really do. For me, collaborative poetry is a way, is a formal gesture. I mean, this is a list poem, so there's one sort of form already implied. But I think by inviting someone else into the poem, it does open it up form-wise, because the magic of doing a collaborative poem is that you really never know what the other poet is going to write. Even you may try to lead him or her, you know, in a certain direction, and then it just completely switches, and the poem switches. So I think there is a certain amount of fluidity. I mean, it's not a fixed form. It's more of a flood forming. I mean, anything could happen, and I think that's sort of why I like collaborating so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens in the editing process with collaboration? I mean, how did you handle that?
Well, this is the first time Sandy and I didn't even really know each other that well, which seems like a very bizarre kind of poem to do with someone that you don't know that well. But he and I were just casual friends, and he'd sent me this article. And then I sort of, flirted, you know, like kind of tried to entice him to do this poem with me because I thought it would be really fun. And he was game for it, and we went back and forth. And we were pretty ruthless. This is the first time I've ever worked with a man. I don't know if that made it different, but I'd always set these really strong boundaries. I worked with Maureen Seaton on three different volumes, and with another poet, Amy Lemon, a dear friend of mine, on a book. And we were always like, well, we'll only change. We had these rules, like, we can change our own lines, but not the other person's lines. We were very, like, gentle, and with Maureen especially, we would rather throw the poem away than hurt each other's feelings. Yeah. We just start over because, yeah, as you can imagine, when you're collaborating, it's just inexhaustible. You just start another one if it's just going nowhere. But I forgot to do that with Sandy. You know, I just didn't even think of it. And then, you know, I get this document with all these red lines and arrows, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is just so wrong. But he was right. And then I was like, oh. And then I was just like, well, what about moving this here? And it was, I think if it would have happened earlier in my career and earlier in my collaboration, I mean, if he would have been the first person I collaborated with, I would have felt completely freaked out.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was like, oh, this is fun. And I was totally non-threatened by it. And I was like, we should move it this way. And then he would say things like, I think these three or four lines just go nowhere. And I'm like, yeah, let's just start over. And
oh, interesting.
So it was very interesting, a different process.
Yeah, it was like a collaborative critique sort of.
Yes, yes.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So many questions, but I'd like to hear some more poems.
Okay. Keeping on this, I thought was just a different way to talk about sex and people kind of trying to make – why do people have sex at a certain point? Like, why do we even bother? And I live in Florida, as you mentioned, and I live in a condominium in Hollywood, Florida, and I get to eavesdrop a lot. I live with a lot of senior citizens and who are deaf, so, which works to my advantage because I talk really loud, and I just write it down. So this is sort of a found poem, I suppose, called Girl Talk, and I – literally heard this at the pool. I wrote it in my notebook and pretty much typed it up. Girl Talk. I lost my Ronnie when I was only 58. 58, can you imagine? I was so young then, but I wasn't interested in anyone else. I often fantasized that Ronnie died. I know, terrible. But then when he really did die, heart, I missed him so much. About a year later, a man tried to touch me at a party. A retirement party for Lulu's husband, Ralph. I slapped him and went home crying before they even served the cake. I spent a decade crying. I didn't even touch myself, if you know what I mean. My daughter gave me this, I don't know what it's called. It was purple and it scared me to death. But then, when I was 68, I met Herbert at the community center. I was volunteering and he came in asking if there were any regular card games. I don't know why I went out with him, perhaps because he seemed very gentle. After our date, Giorgio's, I had the flounder, a little dry but okay, and very nice bread. He asked me back to his condo, Sea Towers, 8th floor, ocean view, very neat, to watch a movie, Turner Classics. Then, after an hour or so, he told me he had a second TV in his bedroom and asked me to lie down with him there. I said, are you crazy? This is our first date. And he said, but I have prostate problems. Really, all I want to do is lie down and hold you. Well, I was hooked. We've been together for over 10 years. No sex. He just kisses me, no tongue even, and rubs my back. His doctor wanted to give him Viagra, but I told him, Herbert, you get those pills and it's all over. He's not interested really either. Sometimes we stay up all night listening to records. He still has a stereo that works and holding hands. It's incredible. I feel like a schoolgirl again.
That's a great poem.
Thank you.
You know, it brings up the idea of research, and I know that you do a lot of research with your poems, but I guess, you know, eavesdropping is a kind of research.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, I wonder how much you said this is something that you heard, but in a found poem, I'm imagining there's a lot of shaping and and altering that goes on.
Right. And even I think just in the imagine, I mean, I didn't have my notebook. I usually always have a notebook with me, and I didn't. Or I think I had the notebook but not the pen, or, you know, some combination was off. So I remember just like listening, trying to remember, and getting home and just kind of, I just went and just typed it all out and then, of course, had to go in and shape it.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think sometimes in eavesdropping, the details we remember or in trying to repeat a story, the details we remember are the details that are story worthy.
Yes.
You know, we forget all the stuff that
or the details that say something about us.
No, it's true. No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What's
it's
important
true.
To us.
Yeah.
I'm not making any judgments.
No, I know exactly what you mean, but it's true. Because you hear it and it sticks because it resonates.
Yeah.
It's true.
Okay. Can you read another?
Sure. This is a poem that actually does have to do with research, not of the eavesdropping kind, but the actual lookup, you know, kind. And it's called Language Police Report. And Diane Ravitch wrote a book actually called The Language Police. And in it, she outlines words that are to be avoided in textbooks that are used in K through 12 in public schools. So basically, I listed, you know, I wrote down these words thinking, oh my God, this is crazy. You know, the words seemed to me to get crazier and crazier. And so what I did was try to use as many as I could just in a mock narrative. So what I'll do is I'll read what I wrote first, the little narrative that's basically just trying to use all the words, and then I'll read it, read the poem, which employs parentheses that tell the reader why this cannot be used.
Okay.
Okay. So here's just the kind of skeleton of the poem. The Language Police. The busybody who lives next door called my daughter a tomboy when she climbed the jungle gym. Then she had the nerve to call her an egghead and a bookworm because she read fairy tales. I'm tired of the language police turning a deaf ear to my complaints. I'm no Pollyanna and will not accept any lame excuses this time. If Alanis Morissette can play God in Dogma, why can't my daughter play stickball on Boys' Night Out? Why can't she build a snowman without that fanatic next door telling her she's going to hell? Do you really think this is what the founding fathers had in mind? That we can't even enjoy our deviled ham sandwiches in peace? I say put a stop to this cult of PC old wives' tales and extremist conservative duffers. As an heiress to the First Amendment, I feel that only a heretic would try to stop American vernacular from flourishing in all its inspirational splendor. All right, so those are, as I said, the skeleton, trying to use as many words as I could, and this is the actual poem. Language Police Report. The busybody, bandit sexist, demeaning to older women, who lives next door, called my daughter a tomboy, banned as sexist, when she climbed the jungle, banned, replaced with rainforest, gym. Then she had the nerve to call her an egghead and a bookworm, both banned as offensive, replaced with intellectual. Because she read fairy, banned because it suggests homosexuality, replaced with elf, tales. I'm tired of the language police turning a deaf ear, banned as handicapism, to my complaints. I'm no Pollyanna, banned as sexist, and will not accept any lame, banned as offensive, replaced with walks with a cane, excuses this time. If Alanis Morissette can play God, banned, in Dogma, banned as ethnocentric, replaced with doctrine or belief, why can't my daughter play stickball, banned as regional or ethnic bias, on Boys Night Out, banned as sexist? Why can't she build a snowman, banned, replaced with snow person, without that fanatic, banned as ethnocentric, replaced with believer, follower, or adherent, next door, telling her she's going to hell, banned, replaced with heck or darn? Do you really think this is what the founding fathers, banned as sexist, replaced with the founders or the framers, had in mind? That we can't enjoy our deviled, banned, ham sandwiches in peace? I say put a stop to this cult, banned as ethnocentric, of PC old wives' tales, banned as sexist, replaced with folk wisdom, an extremist, banned as ethnocentric, replaced with believer, follower, or adherent, conservative duffers, banned as demeaning to older men. As an heiress, banned as sexist, replaced with heir, to the First Amendment, I feel that only a heretic, used with caution when comparing religions, would try to stop American vernacular from flourishing in all its inspirational, banned as patronizing when referring to a person with disabilities, splendor.
Okay. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Denise Duhamel, reading her poetry. You know, that's a wild poem. And I know that book. I actually got that book and was going to write a poem from it, but you beat me too.
Oh, sorry.
And I'm sure there's more than one poem to write.
Absolutely.
But yeah, all that language. And, you know, it also made me think when you were reading it about all those internal censors that we have when we're writing. And, you know, you write something down and you think, oh, I shouldn't use that word. Oh, I shouldn't say it that way. And that's so insidious, that internal censoring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, were you referring to that also in that poem? Or
I really was. I mean, it's almost as though when someone said, and I agree, I mean, obviously I think heir is better than heiress and actor is better than actress. But when someone says you can't, you immediately, or when someone tells me I can't, I immediately want to. And I think I was thinking about the language police in that, yes, we can try to stop language, but it doesn't really mean it's going to stop people from feeling certain ways. And it's almost as though I was trying to make the argument dubious and sort of covert, because I don't really believe, I mean, I really do believe in political correctness.
You really do or don't?
I do. I mean, I do to a certain extent. I mean, I do think I would rather be called a poet than a poetess. I would rather, I mean, I do think that a lot of language can be demeaning or, I don't know, just sort of dismissive. So, I mean, I'm aware of all that stuff. Like, if I'm going to talk about a person I don't know, I will say he or she, or I'll just say she. You know, I'm kind of just as bad as actually. But I just think the idea of actual words,
yeah,
I felt was so crippling.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, I remember around the same time reading about a child came home and you had to match. It was a sheet where there was a mother, a father, a baby, and then on one side and the other side was like a lawnmower, a dishwasher, and a rattle, and you kind of like mm-hmm. have to mix them up.
What
and then,
goes
of course,
with what?
Yeah, and the mother did mow the lawn. Oh, you're wrong. You know, that kind of, I mean, it was, you know, that kind of thinking, I think, obviously.
Yeah, but it's kind of surprising to me that you say you believe in political correctness, knowing your books. Because it seems like you break every rule and go into places that make us very uncomfortable, which I think is a strength.
Well, I guess maybe I don't. Maybe that came out wrong. I think I believe in giving people dignity. And I always think, like, there's a rule of comedy where you usually make fun of people above your station.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like fun for – it's funny when poor people make fun of the rich, but it's not quite as funny when rich people make fun of the poor. You know, there's always something kind
there's of... There's a lot of roles around.
There also. Are, yeah, yeah. There's, but I also think, like, I think there's things I can say that are funnier because I'm saying than a guy.
Right.
There, I've said it. I was trying not to say that, but there, I've said it.
That's a whole nother show. Okay. We have time for one more poem.
Okay. All right, here we go. This is a villanelle. And some famous villanelles you might remember are Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night by Dylan Thomas, or One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. And it's just a poem that repeats whole lines. And this is called Please Don't Sit Like a Frog, Sit Like a Queen. And this is based on graffiti inside the cubicle of a ladies' bathroom in the university in the Philippines. Remember to pamper, remember to preen. The world doesn't reward a pimply girl. Don't sit like a frog, sit like a queen. Buy a shampoo that gives your locks sheen. If your hair is straight, get it curled. Remember to pamper, remember to preen. Keep your breath minty and your teeth white and clean. Paint your nails so they glisten, 10 pearls. Don't sit like a frog, sit like a queen. Smile, especially when you're feeling mean. Keep your top down when you take your car for a whirl. Remember to pamper, remember to preen. Don't give in to cravings, you need to stay lean, so you can lift up your skirt as you prance and twirl. Don't sit like a frog, sit like a queen. Don't marry the professor, marry the dean. Marry the king, don't marry the earl. Remember to pamper, remember to preen. Don't sit like a frog, sit like a queen.
The poetry of Denise Duhamel. Thank you so much for being here. That was great.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun. Thanks.
You've been listening to Prosody, featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment Newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody on 90.5 FM.